The kids with the inattentive ADHD, the daydream kids, they sneak through the system. They're not disruptive. So the teacher says they're doing fine. Academically, they're doing horribly, but they're doing fine behaviorally in school. So the teachers say, oh, not an issue for me, not an issue for you. We're good to go. Not true. The kid's failing socially, not doing well. And so the daydreamy, inattentive kids are the ones that sneak under the radar. And that's the one I really pushed to get evaluated.
Are you raising a family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice.
Our guest today has spent 43 years in pediatric practice, and treating children with ADHD is the center of his clinical work and research. Based in rural Kentucky, he has served families who often had nowhere else to turn without the luxury of nearby specialists. Dr. Stan Block is a highly published private pediatrician and best-selling author. He is a nationally recognized voice in pediatric research, and he has watched ADHD diagnosis evolve from the inside out. Welcome, Dr. Block.
Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate it.
Dr. Block, you've done a lot, and clearly 43 years in pediatric practice in rural Kentucky, managing some of the largest caseloads. You're resilient and insightful and likely resourceful. Before we get into specifics, I'd love to hear in your own words what first drew you to the ADHD diagnosis specifically and why it became one of the many focuses of your career.
Well, I came out from Wake Forest University and from a pediatric residency in 1982, where I finished 3 years there. And then when I came out to practice, we had all sorts of children coming in with behavior problems, trouble with ADHD symptoms, which is hyperactivity mostly, and then school failure. And as a consequence, we were just now starting to dabble with the word ADHD in kids. As you know, probably at least 5% of kids have some form of ADHD that warrants management and or therapy. So they also determined that when you tried psychotherapy and behavioral therapy, it just didn't work by itself. But when you added a stimulant, in this case, which is methylphenidate at that time, it seemed to help tremendously. And the kids did better with school, social functioning, and interactions with their teachers, interactions with their academics as well. So that's how I got started. So basically, early in my career in 1983, 84, we started dabbling with it, and I started learning all about the medications and how to use them.
Sounds like so much.
Side effects. So we'll get into those in a minute.
Yes. I mean, wow. I love that you took us back to that history and the fact that so much has happened since then. And right now, with parents tuning in who may be hearing a lot, but they're still really unclear about the basics, how do you explain in plain terms when a family walks into your office for the first time with concerns about ADHD?
Well, there's two different basic forms of ADHD. 65% of them have hyperactivity, and that's mostly boys. And then the other 30% are just inattentive or daydreamy or spacey, and that's predominantly girls and really heavy in middle school and adolescent when we start seeing that evolve. Then there's a 5% mixture, which have both severe inattention and also hyperactivity. But again, most of the hyperactive kids have major inattention as well, but their behavior is so disruptive that they can't function at school and at home, etc. So we can talk about those three categories in a minute. But basically, I would say when a parent comes in, how is your child functioning? Is it functioning adequately academically, functioning adequately socially, functioning adequately at home and the family? So if there's interference in any of those three spheres of their life, then most likely you're going to consider management more than just behavioral therapy. And that's when you want to come talk to us. So the people who manage ADHD for the most part in the USA are the pediatricians. All of us are taught well in our residency and our programs how to manage medications, et cetera. And if we're paying attention, we should be very adept at it as well. The American Academy of Pediatrics came out and said, along with the several august bodies, including child psychiatry, that the mainstay of diagnosing ADHD is based on teacher's checklist. And so we use them right and left in our office. In fact, you can't come in for ADHD workup or follow-up unless you have a teacher's checklist in kids under age 14. Now, 14 has to go, you can't do it. It's difficult to do. So we allow for that notion, and we'll work around that. But for the average kid, and the majority of our kids under age 14, we use a teacher's checklist. And those checklists, they're free if you go to the right source, but Vanderbilt has one. We use the old Connors, which we would take as a template. But basically, we get the checklist first, and then we'll examine those. And we look at also how the parents fill out the checklist. Now, what happens occasionally, there's dichotomy between the two. And you're going, one of them's discrepant from the other big time.
Yes, that happens. We've got to look at
that. That happens actually probably 5 or 10% of the time. And part of the reason may be the teacher's not paying attention to the kid. Okay? And that only applies, for the most part, to the kid with hyperactive ADHD. The kids with the inattentive ADHD, the daydream kids, they sneak through the system. They're not disruptive. So the teacher says they're doing fine. Academically, they're doing horribly, but they're doing fine behavioral in school. So the teachers say, oh, not an issue for me, not an issue for you. We're good to go. Not true. The kid's failing socially, not doing well. Mm-hmm. And so the daydreamy, inattentive kids are the ones that sneak under the radar. And that's the one I really push to get evaluated.
Yes, that is on my list of questions to think about, because I know I see that in my practice too. Let's think about parents. Are there signs that parents consistently miss or misread?
Well, that would be the inattentive ADHD. The kids who are hyperactive, they're obvious. They're bouncing off the wall. They're disruptive. They're tearing up things. They're into everything. They have intense curiosity and dismantling your vacuum cleaner. That's your main obvious one. But again, going back to one point about the discrepancy. So if the parent says kid's very hyperactive at home and off the wall, then at school he's behaving like, a role model.
Yes. And that happened
all the time. And that's a behavioral discipline issue. So you got to go through that. But you have to make certain the teacher's paying attention. So that's why I try to get two or three different teachers critical.
Great idea.
If you can get it. So you have to allow, in elementary school, you have to allow the PE teacher or the counselor to do a checklist for you. That's how you get around that issue of, is a teacher paying attention? But 95% of the teachers are on task. They got it down.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. And because what I notice for some kids, even with ADHD, because of the structure of the school, they actually can function really well. Now, that's a small percentage and continue to do well academically and socially. But those ones that you mentioned where you really see a dysfunction there. And it's so interesting because often there's a discrepancy between home. And I try to remind people, and I want to tell people listening too, that by definition, ADHD needs to be present in more than one setting. So I'm glad that you identified that it has to be present in the home as well as in school, and show that there is some form of functional discrepancy as well. ADHD can present itself in a range of ways, often beyond the more classic symptoms like distraction or restlessness. So sometimes it can be misunderstood.
And we also explore actually the core symptoms of ADHD.
Yes.
There are three of them. Number one is inattention, of course.
Yes.
Number two is impulsivity. Then you get the plus minus, the 60% versus 35% of hyperactivity. So that's the way they present. And the hyperactive ones are identified real early and quickly.
What are some unexpected symptoms you've seen in your patients? And going through the diagnostic criteria, I kind of feel like we need to expand it. Or are these just comorbidities, or what we say, other symptoms like anxiety, depression that go along with the ADHD, not just signs of ADHD?
Okay, so in my world, we see two other major things that go coexists with a lot of the hyperactive ADHD boys. That is conduct disorders or the destructive and the kind of antisocial behavior. And that was a more difficult one to treat and to manage. So that often requires help from your psychologist and your counselors. Then you also have the oppositional defiant disorder. That's a big one. And to me, that's wrapped into the ADD diagnosis all in one. They try to differentiate it. But to me, response to medication, it's part of the disorder in my point of view, and you must deal with it as well. And that's where they're defiant. They're always saying no, no, no to everything you ask or tell them to do. So that's a critical one that's a branch off the ADHD itself.
Yes, and anxiety, I would add to that list. And it's interesting, you mentioned Vanderbilts, which are one of the questionnaires that we give to parents as well as teachers. And I'm very grateful that you mentioned that sometimes it takes more than one teacher. And I always encourage both parents to fill that out if both are available. And what the Vanderbilt does is it sifts out some of those other diagnoses that you mentioned, like conduct, oppositional defiant, and then anxiety. You brought up such a great point that ADHD looks very different in boys versus girls, and you've seen thousands of patients. Can you talk us through the difference and explain why girls are so often missed or misdiagnosed?
Okay. Well, there's a subset of girls with ADHD who actually have the hyperactive form. But that's probably 10 or 15% of them. Majority of girls present with the inattentive form of ADHD. They still have the impulsivity, but the key factor is they're spacey, they're daydreamy, they can't get away from their distraction, they're disorganized, they're messy. And all these factors come into play when the parents look at the child going, why can't you ever get anything done? Why are you always in la-la land? That girl is the one that we really want to hone in on, because I find in middle school and high school, they come with school failure because they can't concentrate, yet their brains are perfectly fine. They can do the work. And I ask them, how are you? Do you understand what you're doing? Can you do the work? They say, yeah. I said, but you can't produce because they get too distracted with everything else going on around them. They're daydreaming. So in essence, this group is the one that we save big time, because their grades will grow from D's and F's to A's and B's overnight once you start on the right medication. So that's a critical group that we save. And I see a lot of those girls. So that's part of my routine questions. How are your grades at school? I ask every middle schooler and high schooler. If they say, oh, we're not doing well, we're getting D's and F's, et cetera, then I start honing in and saying, could we be possibly dealing with the inattentive form of ADHD? Now, I have a whole differential.
Those teen years, yeah, they add like a whole different complexity once they hit those teen years. What are some of the new challenges that emerge in adolescence that parents might not be anticipating?
Oh, my gosh. I raise four daughters.
Oh, that's wonderful.
They're all grown, healthy adults. These were kids who were...
Congratulations.
Who got postgraduate degrees, each one of them, but they're a handful. They'll test your mettle as a father. So first thing you want to learn is, this is nothing personal. Because whenever they go off on you and they're having a bad day, they're going to kick you as their sounding board. That's where they're going to ventilate. And as a father, you have to be the bedrock of the family and say, no, wait a minute. Let's sit down and let's talk about this a little bit more. And you have to allow them to ventilate, because they're going to slam doors, they're going to huff off, they're going to roll their eyes at you, do all that stuff. Take nothing personally. It's not you. Who owns the problem? They do. You just have to help them and or listen to them.
Yes. Who owns the problem? They do. That's powerful. I like that. I'm going to use that when I talk to parents in the future. And I want to remind parents of that too, who are listening. So
this too shall pass.
Yeah, my mom used to say that all the time.
It's biblical.
So once parents suspect ADHD, what's the first step? Let's make it super clear for parents listening. Who should they call? The pediatrician, the child psychologist, a neuropsychologist, their teacher? Kind of walk us through the evaluation process and what families can expect.
Okay. So I'm in rural Kentucky. We don't have any of those other people. We barely have counselors, okay? So we are the first line and the only line for most kids with ADHD, which actually is appropriate, though, because we're the ones who are going to be diagnosed and we're the ones going to be treating it.
Managing it, yeah.
So we'll go through treatments in a minute. But anyways, so basically I have them, they suspect something. The most common reason is either they're overactive and hyperactive and being destructive in school, or they're school failures. Those are the two biggest reasons they come in for. There are other ones that can present as well, as drug abuse, et cetera, and then conduct disorders. But in essence, those are the two main presenting features. So we'll go through and say, before you come in, would you get the teacher's checklist? Or if we see them in the office and they're bouncing off the wall, we ask, how is your child doing at school? How's your child functioning socially, interactions, child being shunned all the time? Do you have to say no 1,000 times in an hour? Then that child is suspicious for having ADHD. So then we get teacher's checklist, and we try to get more than one, especially in early elementary school and middle school. And then we have those filled out. They come to the office, and we'll go through the screen. And the screen, you're right, it covers a ton of stuff. It also covers anxiety and depression in there, which are comorbidities and are results of some kids with ADHD. And then we ask about the grades and academics. The best way to get a grade is their achievement test. So we ask about their achievement test. Bring the report card if you can. But the grades, if they're inattentive terribly, they're not going to reflect their intellectual function.
If today's conversation hits close to home for you, please like this episode and subscribe to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have questions for me or topics you'd like for me to discuss in a future episode, please leave us a comment on YouTube or send me an email. Stick around for more information on ADHD diagnosis and medication. Yes, I draw a picture for families when they come into my office, and I put, you know, school grades, you know, academics in the middle of it. And then I draw a circle and I do four parts. And you defined that so well. One part is, could this be ADHD? One is it another learning disorder? And then intellectual disability does have to be ruled out, as well as then the fourth branch of that circle is any psychological concerns, like you mentioned. And your 1998 research was groundbreaking in part because it demonstrated that primary care pediatricians, not just specialists, could effectively diagnose and manage ADHD. Is that still the right approach today, or have things shifted?
Oh, it's still the ideal way to approach it. That was published in Pediatric Clinics of North America. It's a 30-page paper that I wrote on a whim, and that was before I was really into writing a lot, and it was a work of love to write it all down and get all the nuances in there. The medications are a bit different now. We have a bigger armamentarium.
Yes, we do.
Actual approach to everything is still solid. It still applies today.
Yes, and teachers play an important role in this, as well as parents, as you mentioned. With AI, you know, they're looking for answers and diagnosis. How useful is AI for parents if they go to it compared to a formal clinical evaluation that you so eloquently defined for us?
Well, AI can be a useful tool. It's always a tool. It's not the end all to be all.
Yes.
You can't look at your kid and say, okay,
yes,
wall, or your child's depressed, or your child's got a conduct disorder in real opposition to you constantly, or it can't tell you if the child's just not functioning well. Also, the physical maladies they might have that exacerbate ADD. So there's all sorts of things. Plus, you need to be able to read the child, especially in teenagers in middle school. You have to be able to read that child, what is going on behind that facade. And sometimes it's hidden, like the cutters and beaters and all that stuff. You got to watch for that. And then you get into teen love romances, which will really knock that ADHD symptomatology off the wall. So anyways, you got several things you have to look at and examine for.
You mentioned medication. Let's go back to that. Let's dive in. When parents come to talk to me about ADHD, one of their number one concerns is medication. Some parents are for it, others are against it. And you've been prescribing medications for decades, and you've also published extensively on pharmacologic intervention. What has your experience taught you, and when is and isn't the medication the right call?
Okay, so first step I'd say is the ADHD symptomatology interfering socially, academically, intellectually, and in family. If you have interference with any of those four spheres in your life, then you need to consider medication. That's the first step. If you're doing well and you have ADHD, and you're functioning well and you're getting on. I have a daughter with ADHD. She fell out of her chair every supper time. She knocked over two glasses of milk every supper time. She was bouncy and off the wall, but she functioned well. She was smart. She was social. She had no difficulties until she hit med school. Then the work became overwhelming. She couldn't function she couldn't function with her attention enough to get all that work done. So then it becomes academic difficulties can exacerbate the problem. So kid may be functioning fine, and it hits a certain level of high school or college, et cetera, and fall down. That's when you say, oh, we need to help you. And medication makes all the difference in the world because, again, the primary target for symptomatology is inattention. So again, if we look at that point of view, then you know when medication is going to be an important adjunct to what you're going to do for this child.
What's your honest assessment of stimulant medications like Ritalin, Adderall, Concerta? I'm using the brand name because it can get confusing when we use the other names, you know, for people that are listening. What have you seen them do well, and what are the real risks parents should understand?
So let's go back to the point number one. So when you see a child with ADHD and you want to prescribe medication, you have a whole list of factors you have to figure. Number one, are they real skinny already? Are they with appetite? So you don't want to suppress that if you can avoid it. So you have to be careful. And if you're going to do stimulants, you have to really be careful with that. A child who has depression, again, be careful with your stimulants. A child who is obese, you have to be careful with what you give them sometimes as well. So you got, again, the parents say, oh, I don't want to be walking around like a zombie. Occasionally, your child with stimulant medication will have major interference with their attention. So therefore, they look like they're in a zombie land. The other big thing I see with stimulants that you have to be aware of is after the first week or two, they cry constantly for the inattentive and the hyperactive ADD. Because before then, they never paid attention to a thing you said. They become ultra sensitive. So I tell them, you have to ignore that crying in emotional outburst the first 2 weeks. That's why I try to start the stimulants with kind of a half dose to medium dose before. I don't hit the target dose that I think they might need right off the bat, because that emotional outburst, that sensitivity, it can be overwhelming. It'll stop the medication, never give it again. So you want to do it slow, okay? Then there's other aspects, and that is the age range, what age group you're dealing with. If you're treating with ADHD, you want to avoid certain medications at all costs. I don't prescribe Adderall. I don't prescribe it. There's too many issues with diversion and drug use and substance abuse with that medication. Now, Adderall XR is a little bit different beast, but it still is wildly abused. The number five abused drug in the USA is Adderall. Number five. Okay. Almost up there with OxyContin. So again, I don't prescribe it to college and high schoolers, and try to avoid it in middle school if I can. So again, going back, the number one drug I use are the stimulants, and the number one drug of that is usually Concerta. Now, Concerta is a great drug. It lasts about 10 to 12 hours. You have to write the brand name. There's two generics out there, and then the FDA has told them they're not bioequivalent. They don't work as well. They act just like a short-acting stimulant, a short-acting methylphenidate or a Ritalin-type drug. So in essence, I use Concerta first. Then that comes to the issue. Can they swallow a pill?
Right. That is an issue.
You got to go way back and start. All right. So we'll just assume they can swallow a pill. So Concerta first, and you give them, that's going to work 70% of the time. So after three trials of some stimulant, you got Concerta first. Then you could try Vyvanse, which is a combination pill of different stimulants, amphetamine type drugs. And then you can use a drug like, let's see, what's the other one I want to use here? Got ahead of myself here. All right. So anyways, you can use the drug of Concerta first, then you go to Vyvanse, and then Focalin XR. Now, Focalin XR is kind of my third line choice, but Focalin XR has some issues. Frequently, it doesn't get long acting. You don't get 10 to 12 hours like you will with the other two. And you have to really be careful with that drug because it's not going to work as well frequently as you would expect it to. So again, if I use Focalin XR and it's not lasting very long, it's real. They're metabolizing it fast. So what I do is I use a second best alternative. Focalin is a great drug, but it lasts 5 to 6 hours. But guess what you can do? Morning dose and a lunchtime dose at school with a nurse, and you get a good 12 hours of solid, good drug effectiveness. So that's the 1-2-3 punch I use. And then after that, if I can't get results with that, then you're going to the black box of pediatrics, which is the non-stimulants.
Yes. I was just going to ask you that. Non-stimulants are an awesome option as well for some children. When do you reach those instead?
Okay. So if they're having major trouble with sleep already, sometimes you want to go to the non-stimulants. If they have trouble with weight, you want to go to non-stimulants. If they have trouble with parents say, I don't want to be acting like a zombie, you want to be sure to get them started on something that's not going to zombify them, if you would. You can use a stimulant. The one that's been most studied and widely used is atomoxetine or Strattera. I've written 3 different papers on Strattera. And guess what? When you start Strattera, you really want to go slow and go low dose. All right.
Low and slow is what I say.
And with Strattera, the paper I published showed that you want to start it at nights because these daytime sleepiness is a real problem with it. If you start at night, you don't get that. Plus, you don't get the GI upset as much. So, again, what stops medication effectiveness and being used long-term? Side effects.
There's a big difference, too, that we should mention about the non-stimulants and the stimulant medications. What should parents know about those differences in regards to, like, how you take them? You mentioned one, which is taking the atomoxetine or Strattera at night. I also advise that they take that every day. There's no blockout days, so to speak. Is that correct?
Yes, we can talk about drug holidays in a minute. The atomoxetine is a complex story. So in this study, what we did, we started on 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, which is a kind of a lower dose, at nights. And we started at the same dose during the daytime. We found that discontinuations were significant if you started in the morning. So what you want to do is start it at nights. It's not as effective, though. So you use the nighttime dose to get them used to it. You have to take it once a day, every day, without fail. You can't go on any drug holidays. It's a bit more expensive, so expense can be an issue as well, and drug coverage, it can be an issue as well. But you start it at nights, go slow, and you slowly build up to the appropriate dose, which is between like 1.2 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram for the physician. Anyway, so once you've done that, then you get them down, start it, and switch over to morning dose. It is more effective with a morning dose. So parents have to allow for the slow uptake and the slow progress with the medicine of atomoxetine or Strattera. So if you tell them it's going to take 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks before you get full effectiveness, then they're prepared for it because it's not like stimulants. 1 or 2 doses, boom, you see a difference. This is a slow-go process. So it's a great drug. It's only about 60% effective. So what I suggest, start at nights, go slow, build up your dose, and then switch over to daytime in 3 to 4 or 6 weeks, which is how we did the study. It's a wonderful paper. I'm so proud of that by myself. I quote it a lot.
You should be. We've talked a lot about how, let's go back to kind of talking about what to do at school with teachers. And a lot of times parents often feel lost. What do you tell them about how to approach the conversation with a teacher who may not fully understand what their child is dealing with? And in addition, can you explain like the difference between the accommodations that kids can have at school, like the 504 plan and the IEP?
Okay, starting with the 504 and the IEP. So basically, they overlap to me as a significant. The IEP is more when you get a child who's having struggles with school, a parent can request an IEP. So if you write on a piece of paper or anything and say, I want my child tested psychoeducationally or IQ testing, then the school has 60 school days to get them tested, the federal law. So that gives you an idea where they stand intellectually. The counselors and the psychologists who do the testing can give you an inkling of the child being hyperactive or not, but they cannot make the diagnosis. It depends, again, on the checklist from the teachers is the gold standard. They can put them in our office, but they cannot make the diagnosis. Plus, they can't treat, but they can help us a lot for other things, including emotional problems and or academic problems. It also gets rid of that category that you need to screen for, which is, can they intellectually do the work? Are they way behind and struggling and all disrupted because they can't get the work done? And the 504 is more of, what are we going to do for you? So that one tells you, what can we do? Special classes, always put these kids up front of the class. They don't need 30 kids in front of them. We're going to distract them. So they should be up front of the class, in front, we're closest to the teacher. So the teacher is their main focus. So that's the kind of Section 504 things you get. They also need more time frequently because they're active with what they're doing. So special testing, ACT testing, et cetera, they get more time because of that. So there are certain things they do. And then they may need learning disability educational remediation as well. So you need to allow for that as well. And that's where that school is really handy and can help you. Now, you can do individual psycho-educational evaluation from private psychologist center. But I'm in rural Kentucky. I only have one that I can use hardly. And it costs so much, and insurance doesn't cover it. So I basically have to do the poor man's approach to psychoeducational evaluation. I use the school counselors. And, you know, they're overwhelmed them at times, I'm sure. But it gets the job done, and it gets us where we need to be, which is, can the child do the work academically?
You know, I really appreciate all of the wisdom that you're sharing, because these are key points that we need to keep in mind. And you've been practicing since before ADHD was even accepted as a real diagnosis. You explained that to us in the beginning. How dramatically has the understanding of this condition changed over your career? And what do you think we might still be getting wrong?
Okay. Well, the biggest problem is incorrect diagnosis. I hear the word lazy, and a child's
diagnosed. I know. I've heard that.
No child is lazy. They either can't do the work academically, or they got severe inattentive ADHD. They're not lazy. You don't get that. They want to please. They want to get the work done. If they can't do it, then you need to be evaluating for it, because they're frustrated. And if the more frustrated the kid gets, the more problems they're going to have later on in life, which means substance use, which means school failure, which means incarceration. All those things are looking at you if you don't get them help. And certain kids, especially with severe ADD, who are in unsupportive households, they're really at risk for this.
Yes, absolutely. And there's sometimes significant debate over whether ADHD is overdiagnosed or underdiagnosed. What's your vantage point in rural America? What's your read on that?
Yes, both. It's both. It's both. We have a lot of underdiagnosis, especially in teen years and middle school years, you know, academic failure, called lazy, not getting the work done. And then the kids that are hyperactive now, I want you to remember this. When the kids are ages about 3 to 6, boys are very, very active. And they mimic the hyperactive ADD. But over time, a large percentage of them, probably more than half, will outgrow this hyperactive phase. I have my first grandson. He was the most hyperactive little boy I've seen. I was going, my God, she had to put a harness on him.
Aw.
Yeah, because he was off the wall. He'd run. Go to a restaurant. He's running up and down the hall.
We got to make sure he's safe, right?
And I go, my God, that boy is destined for medication. He hit age 6 and it was gone.
Aw.
It's magically gone. And he's now a pre-med student. He's got straight A's. He's brilliant. He got a perfect score on his ACTs, et cetera. So anyways, there is hope, but sometimes you just have to be patient. So mother's instinct will often be helpful. Mother's instinct can tell you, this child's a bit too much. I can't handle it. It doesn't respond to me very well. And then with your help of your pediatrician, you can ferret through it. But I have a lot of kids that come in that by age 5 or more, they're off the wall and they probably need medication. One thing I think that really puts you in the category of ADHD as a preschooler or pre-kindergarten kid is the aggressiveness, the amount of physical aggressiveness. So if they're really aggressive and they can't modulate that at all, and they can't modulate anything around the teachers, around adults, that child most likely has some severe ADHD. So you have to watch for that. So that aggression is one key factor that might help you get in the category. But that's still not 100%. It's sometimes over time you'll go, oops, that child matured and grew his hyperactiveness.
And these behavior concerns are important to bring up because we know, and also based on your research and publication, that the best outcomes come from not just medication management, but also behavior therapy.
Yes. Now, behavior therapy is an important adjunct if you've got availability.
That's true.
I don't have it. So I have to depend on my school and my teachers to be the behavioral therapist. And I do have counselors around here, LCSWs, that can help the parents with discipline issues. So we use them a fair amount as well. If the kid still doesn't get enough modulation of their hyperactivity and disruptiveness from medication alone. So we kind of look at it, proof's in the pudding. Is the medication going to help enough? If not, then we move on within a few weeks, say, okay, you're going to need extra help for behavioral therapy at that point. But again, that CBT stuff, which is so good, we don't have access to it. That's a specialized group. And so in rural America, it's not happening.
I know. And just for those listening, CBT is cognitive behavior therapy. And I also encourage parents to get some additional education. For parents who already have a diagnosis in hand and is trying to get through the day, what's the most important piece of advice you give families to make home life more manageable?
Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics has a wonderful pamphlet on ADHD, and every parent gets that pamphlet who's either considering a diagnosis or we know has a diagnosis. That's probably the simplest little tidbit that we could give them to help them through this crisis trying to figure out what's going on with their kid.
Dr. Block, thank you so much for your insights today. Where can listeners find you and learn more about your work?
Well, I have a new book I just published. It's a memoir. It's 480 pages currently. It's called Pediatrics Around the Block. And it's got my life story in there, and it's got my case conundrums, my enigmas over the decades. And I also have a ton of information about raising babies, the little nuances that are new in pediatrics that I uncovered. So anyways, the book is, I think, a valuable source of lots of things. And as far as vaccines, I have at least 5 essays on why you want to get your vaccines and the reasons behind it, and the reasons why we do what we do as pediatricians about the vaccines. I also, at the end of the book, have about 40 or 50 pages on my work in vaccines itself. So everybody says, I don't believe vaccines, we don't trust them. I did the work on almost every vaccine we use today. Me, personally, with my office research group, did the original research. I want you to know, you can trust the work has been done. All this nonsense about placebo control trials, that is just smokescreen. That's nonsense. You can't do it. And I explain in the book why you can't do it and how you get it done without doing placebo control trials. All right. So all those things are in there and more. So it's a wonderful resource for you, especially if you're a new parent. There's a ton of information. And the teenage girls, lots of information. I also have a whole essay on management of child who's a slow learner versus ADHD. That's in there as well. So differential diagnosis, how to manage that. And I also have an essay on teenage girls and how to differentiate that ADHD versus non-ADHD issues. So again, there's a whole plethora of wonderful tidbits in there that will help you through life raising your children. And it comes from a guy who's been around for decades.
Well, this is all great to know. Thank you for sharing those resources. And thank you, Dr. Black, for joining me today. Parents, if today's conversation gave you even one tool to help your child navigate this journey, then Dr. Block did exactly what he has spent 43 years doing, showing up for kids and the families who love them. Trust what you heard today, trust your instincts, and know that you're not alone in this. And until next time, I'm Dr. Sarah, and let's grow up together.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.